Support for Access Utah comes from the Utah Humanities Council, enriching cultural, intellectual, and civic life by providing opportunities for all Utahns to explore life's most engaging questions and the wonders of the human experience.
Thanks for joining us for Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. And we're going to make some changes from the previously announced program. We're going to start the program today with a review of the New Hampshire primaries with New Hampshire Public Radio reporter Dan Gorenstein. We'll try to get to Mr. Gorenstein on a little later in the program. Having trouble reaching him today, probably the craziness of the post-primary day. As you no doubt have read, Mitt Romney solidified his front-runner status in a big way, 39%. Ron Paul, a solid second at 23%, and former Utah Governor John Huntsman, 17%, which he says third place gives him a ticket to ride, and he's going on to South Carolina. We'll review that if we're able to get a hold of Mr. Gorenstein. We'll move up this particular segment. What should we do about distracted driving? We had a distracted driving summit on the federal level. You've been reading those reports, I'm sure, and Secretary of Transportation Ray LaHood calls this a national epidemic. We're going to be talking with University of Utah Professor David Strayer, who has studied the effects of cell phone use on drivers with the driving simulators, some very striking findings, and with Rob Reynolds, Executive Director of Focus Driven. It's a group which advocates for the elimination of cell phone use while driving and other factors to reduce distracted driving. And I believe we do have Rob Reynolds on the line. We'll bring Rob Reynolds in right now. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on.
I'm guessing you agree with Secretary of Transportation Ray LaHood that national epidemic, is that too strong?
No, I don't believe that it is. I mean, you can't look at any other issue that affects drivers in the same way that this issue does, because there are so many people right now in the United States that have cell phones. In fact, the number of cell phones accounts outnumbers the number of people in the United States, and that's all people, people even who don't drive. So it's a ubiquitous issue. We've all encountered it on the road. We know that it causes crashes, and to say that it's an epidemic is not understating it.
So your group, are you fighting against, obviously, cell phone driving? In fact, right with your name on your website, which is, by the way, focusdriven.org, advocates for cell-free driving. What else are you hoping to reduce?
Well, all forms of distracted driving are harmful in terms of the amount of crashes, and we're talking property damage, we're talking injuries, and we're talking deaths. And our group really does two things. It supports the victims of distracted driving crashes, specifically cell phone distracted driving crashes. That's really our main focus, because we know that if we're attacking that issue, we're taking the largest chunk of the causation of crashes that we know that we can address, in much the same way we did in the 80s with drunk driving.
I was going to ask about drunk driving. Do you see this as similar, having a similar arc, that this will take work over a long period of time to not only change laws but to change attitudes and behavior?
Yeah, there's so many similarities, and I'm glad you brought that up. In fact, Dr. David Strayer's research touches on this as well in some ways, and I'm sure he can speak to it better than I can. But I think attitudes, if you would have asked people in the 70s and even the early 80s about having drinks while they're driving, you know, the common thing used to be have one for the road. And people are much more conservative in their view now. It's not just the laws, but it's also a social taboo. And we'd like for it to be, you know, 5-10 years from now when we're sitting around in a discussion like this saying, do you remember when we thought it was a great idea to text and to update my Facebook and to talk to people and have heated conversations while I'm driving a car that could potentially hurt myself and other people?
I want to run this past you. This is on the front page of your website. Almost 70% of respondents to a 2010 AAA Foundation for Traffic Safety survey reported talking on a cell phone while driving in the previous 30 days, yet nearly 2 in 3 drivers said that drivers talking on cell phones are a threat to their personal safety. There's a big disconnect. I guess there's a lot of work to be done there.
Well, and I think some of that is just reporting, maybe the way the questions are being asked. mean, I think there's a much larger group of people who can say that they either do it on a semi-regular basis or on a regular basis. And, you know, it's one of those convenience factors. And it's also, again, a social thing. If you see, you know, five or six people passing you in traffic or next to you in traffic and they're talking on their cell phone, and then your cell phone rings, your compulsion is going to be to pick that device up and answer it, or to activate it in a hands-free way. And again, this goes to some of the research that Dr. Strayer has done. You know, when you're talking on a phone, whether it's handheld or hands-free, it doesn't really matter. The impairment that causes is it increases your risk about four times of being involved in a crash. That is the same impairment that somebody who is driving at 0.08 blood alcohol content is at. So, again, you know, there's a similarity there. And we're looking at that as a standard for safety when we're talking about drinking and driving. We need to look at it as a standard for safety as well for use of mobile communications for the driver, just for the driver.
Let's bring in Dr. Strayer, University of Utah Psychology Professor David Strayer, who's done extensive studies on particularly cell phone use, but has looked at distracted driving. What happens to drivers' thought process and attention when they're using cell phones and other devices? David Strayer, welcome back to you, Access Utah.
Thanks for having me.
And appreciate you coming on a little earlier with Dan Gorenstein not being available. We'll try to bring him in a little later in the program. Remind us, I was reading a sort of a biographical piece on you at the University of Utah website. I hadn't remembered that you got into all this by studying aviation, studying pilots and their multitasking and some problems that happened when they got distracted.
That really is the kind of the impetus for a lot of research on attention, is that post-World War II, planes were starting to crash, and it wasn't really because the pilot was doing something wrong or that the plane had a malfunction. It's just that the demands that were being placed on a pilot exceeded their mental capacities. It was an attentional overload problem. And one of the interesting things was that all the things we learned about what could overload a pilot and make them crash applied directly to what happens when you pick up a cell phone to talk or text or do any other kinds of multitasking activities in the wheel, especially a lot of these more recent electronic devices like talking or texting or interacting with on the Internet.
Before we get into some of the results of your studies, and we've talked about a bit about this on Access UTEP before, I want to review that. I want to throw this open to you and to Mr. Reynolds, also our listeners. There does seem to be a disconnect. We somehow maybe feel like our powers of concentration are better than the other person on the road. We're annoyed by someone talking on their cell phone going down the road, but we don't see that in ourselves. I wonder, Mr. Reynolds, have you seen that as well? I've seen, in fact, I saw a gentleman driving down the interstate one time reading a book. It does seem to we just kind of disconnect that as we get in our cars.
Yeah, I think you make an excellent point. And when I address adults especially, one of the things that always comes up is, yeah, we really have to limit what new drivers are doing, what kids are doing, teens. People associate this risky behavior just with newer drivers, sometimes with older drivers as well. But very infrequently do people say, you know, I myself can be on a phone conversation, and then when I get off, I can't remember the last 12 blocks that I drove. All I know is I've arrived, and I really didn't pay attention to what was going on. And Dr. Strayer, again, can speak to this a lot better than I can, but there's this situation that happens in your brain. It's called an attention blindness. When you're trying to perform two cognitive tasks like that, your brain is switching very quickly back and forth. We've all experienced that. You could be walking and talking on your phone and misstep on a piece of pavement just because your attention, your focus, is drawn to that inward conversation that's happening inside your mind.
Dr. Strayer, before we get into your research, reading again this article, you said that you started noticing people drinking coffee, steering with their knees. I've seen that as well. It does seem to be a problem.
I think it's a problem that's been around for quite some time, but it's just grown worse. It's grown worse with a lot of the gadgets that we carry around in our pockets or our cars are infused with these days. So, you know, 20 years ago, 10 years ago, you couldn't talk on a phone very easily, and most people didn't. But now cars have internet, so you can basically do internet searches, and you can talk on the phone, and you can watch movies. And, you know, the list of things that people are doing is, you know, it kind of amazes me. Certainly people have obviously in the past read books and listened to the radio, and those are, you know, those are dangerous things too. But what we're finding is there's kind of it seems that there may be a compulsion or an addiction factor to some of this technology, that when your phone rings, you feel like you have to answer it. And so, you know, maybe you're going to do that at the worst possible time, and better judgment would have told you not to if you were listening, trying to read a book, for example.
Well, this part of Access Utah, if you just joined us, we're talking about distracted driving. That's something that Secretary of Transportation Ray LaHood recently called a national epidemic. There's a recent national conference on this. Secretary LaHood is pushing for stricter legislation. We're talking with University of Utah Professor David Strayer and with Rob Reynolds, Executive Director of Focus Driven, this group that advocates for elimination of cell phone use. They're trying to reduce distracted driving. Dr. Strayer, remind us, your studies have taken place in a simulator, right, where you can simulate the entire driving experience, complete with, what, accelerator, brakes, and then you test where people's attention goes?
Yeah, certainly. A lot of our studies have a simulator, and basically, it's a car that was basically you've taken the engine out of it, and you've taken the rear end out of it, so you could fit it into a building, and then you're looking at the windshield, you're steering, and have the brakes and everything just out of a regular car. And then the nice thing about the higher resolution graphics we have these days is you can have people drive on a freeway, interact with other traffic and pedestrians in a really realistic type of environment, and then measure very precisely how reaction times changed, how likely people are to be involved in accidents. We've also studied it, you know, in natural settings too. So we've gone to intersections here in Utah and had people observe whether or not somebody came to an appropriate and legal stop when they came to an intersection. We found that someone who's talking on a cell phone is twice as likely to fail to make a legal stop. And given how hazardous intersections are, that's where the bulk of accidents occur, at least in local roadways, is at intersections. To have some kind of an impairment where you're twice as likely to not make a legal stop is something that, it translates into the overall crash risks that were reported just a little bit ago.
How is this equivalent then to drug driving? I think you have made an equivalence.
Well, we have. First of all, there's a way of looking at the risk that's something called epidemiological studies that involves actually going out and looking at real crashes and determining whether or not somebody was on the cell phone or not. And those studies have found that you're four times more likely to be involved in a crash. We've done the same thing in our simulator where we have people driving and then we just measure how likely they get into a crash. And we come up with the same numbers. People are four times more likely to be involved in a crash. And to kind of put that in the context, and it was just mentioned a little earlier, that fourfold crash risk is the equivalent to driving drunk. So when you pick up that phone to talk, you're as impaired as if you were at a 0.08 blood alcohol level. And if you're texting, it's substantially worse. So we're sometimes kidding ourselves that we think we can get away with texting or talking because eventually it will catch up to you.
What is the problem then? And Mr. Reynolds referenced this. Your attention is just elsewhere?
Yeah, I think part of it is very much that when you talk on a cell phone, you're paying attention to the conversation, and so you just neglect parts of driving, and so you don't notice that you ran a red light or that you almost hit somebody or that you were impaired in one way or another. And so that's one of the reasons I think we kid ourselves, is that we're so kind of clueless to our own impaired performance that we continue to do it. But you ask the same person, yes, the person who's been using the phone, did you see the person in front of you when they were on the phone? Did they drive kind of like they were drunk? They'll say, yeah, that person, you know, almost ran me off the road. They should never use their cell phone. So, you know, the thing is, there's a disconnect in the sense that we aren't monitoring our own driving behavior when we're talking on the phone. And I think that's part of the reason why you get this kind of a discrepancy between people supporting laws that would regulate and stop people from using cell phones, but they themselves continue to use it.
So there's not only a disconnect between our behavior as we see it and others, we're not even noticing how bad we're driving.
Right. We're out to lunch, so to speak, when we're talking on a cell phone, because there's, you know, you see people who just ride right through a red light. And I've seen crashes where the police will say, well, what happened? He goes, well, last time I looked, it was a green light. And you can look at some of the traffic cameras that have been installed across the country. And the lights were red for a good 10 seconds. And the person just was so impaired that they didn't even notice the light had been red for at least 10 seconds.
Well, this part of Access Utah, we're talking about distracted driving with Rob Reynolds, Executive Director of Focus Driven, a group that advocates for the elimination of cell phone use while driving. We'll ask Mr. Reynolds what his group is recommending. We're talking with University of Utah Professor David Strayer, studied the effects of cell phone use on drivers. Secretary of Transportation Ray LaHood recently called distracted driving a national epidemic. And you're welcome to join this conversation. I'd be interested in your experiences. Either personally or those that you have observed and what you think about this subject. You can join the conversation at 800-826-1495, 1-800-826-1495. Or you can get an email through to us from our website, upr.org. Dr. Strayer, I remember reading about one of your experiments in the simulator. I can't remember exactly which one it was, where you had a man dressed as a gorilla on the side of the simulated road, and some people did not even notice it.
Yeah, that wasn't so much our work. That's actually an extension of work that was done by Dan Simons at Iowa,
okay,
at Illinois, and also some research that's been kind of followed up at Western Washington University. But yeah, in both cases, something as, you know, how could you not notice a gorilla? How could you not notice a clown juggling as they're walking right in front of you? These are the kinds of really big, blatant things that people just don't see because they're so intent on the conversation, on that cell phone conversation.
And so your studies and other studies have shown that it is dangerous to drive while using a handheld cell phone, while texting. What about hands-free cell use?
Well, I mean, the cognitive demands, the mental overload that we see that was overloading pilots and was overloading drivers when using a handheld cell phone is the same for a hands-free cell phone. We find no difference in terms of the crash risk for a hands-free cell phone compared to a handheld cell phone. And there have been about eight states that make it against the law to use a handheld cell phone while driving, but allow people to use a hands-free cell phone. None of those states has reported any kind of a reduction in fatalities when they made people switch from a handheld to hands-free cell phone. In both cases, they're overloading the brain. They're basically depleting attention and making it so that you're not a safe driver.
How dangerous are other activities? Listening to the radio, talking to someone else in the car?
Listening to the radio doesn't cause any problems. Listening to a book on tape, we've just been doing some research following up on earlier studies we've done. Again, doesn't seem to cause problems. Talking to a passenger, even though you may be having a conversation with the passenger and the next day you may have a conversation with that person on the cell phone, when you're talking to that person on a cell phone, you're impaired. When you're talking to that person in the vehicle, you're not. It has to do, in part, with the fact that a passenger has another set of eyes to help the driver by navigating, pointing out hazards, and just stopping talking if driving becomes really difficult. So the whole nature of the conversation when it's via cell phone is different and creates a mental load that overloads the driver. And for one reason or another, that seems to do with kind of the shared awareness of the driving context. A passenger and a driver adjust their conversation so the aggregate result is that a passenger conversation is not impairing, but that same conversation on a cell phone would be.
Let's turn back to Rob Reynolds, Executive Director of Focus Driven. What specific laws are you advocating? And are you receiving any pushback from personal liberty, individual liberty advocates who would maybe talk about a nanny state? We don't want to legislate everything. Balancing that against the danger of distracted driving, what are you pushing for?
Well, I mean, we certainly recommend the same, or we support the same recommendation that Chairman Deborah Herzman just made on December 13th of 2011, in that all cell phone use that we think is dangerous, poses a credible danger incredible risk to all drivers on the roadways. So we would advocate for no cell phone use at all for the driver. And this includes like those built-in infotainment systems that car companies are putting in now too, that allow you to update Facebook and Twitter and talk and text and do a multitude of things that you would probably never dream of doing unless they were built into a vehicle like this, because they are distracting. When you're driving, you should just be driving. That's where your attention should be. And in terms of pushback, I mean, you can see pushback from a number of different industries. I think in general, the people who stand to lose dollars economically from people not using their cell phones excessively are probably the ones that would have the biggest beef. But also in terms of civil liberties, there's a great disconnect there too, I think, because for example, my daughter was killed by a distracted driver. That driver drove through a red light. Several cars were in the intersection. It was obvious that the light was red. That person wasn't trying to beat the light. They never touched the brakes, never touched their accelerators. And they drove through that red light and careened into the side of my daughter's car and killed her. Now, as a parent, that was a devastating event. As a family, it completely turned us upside down. And when you go back and examine the cause, that person would tell you, I don't know. I don't know what happened. They were completely blanked out. Now, to me, that's alarming. That's alarming not only that that could happen, but also that we don't have laws against that type of distracted driving. We don't have any type of protection against that type of distracted driving. So when we're talking about taking my convenience factor away from being able to talk to somebody on the phone or communicate them via any other means with my smartphone versus the right to life and the right to drive without being killed or injured or otherwise have my property damaged, I don't see how one equates to the other. We're really talking about an issue here that can save lives. That's the bottom line, and it affects us all.
It does seem to be, the science seems to be pretty clear. I think people are becoming perhaps more educated on this. Where do you see behavior changing? Will it take tougher laws? Will it have to follow sort of what happened with drunk driving?
Oh, absolutely. It'll take tougher laws. I mean, they always say advocacy is a three-legged stool, and it takes education, and it takes laws, and it takes enforcement. I don't think we would see the impact we've had with reducing drinking and driving had we not had high visibility enforcement on days and evenings when we knew that people would be drinking and driving. And that was, all the arguments against enforcement and against personal liberties in terms of this issue were used with drinking and driving. We just need to get past this safety blanket, if you will, of I have to have this thing, I have to be able to do this, and realize that it's really tearing people apart, it's destroying families, and it's random. It can happen to any one of us.
David Strayer, your quote in this article talks about some of your work, saying that we're becoming addicted to this technology. I wonder if you're seeing progress. Do you agree? Tougher laws? How do we get behavior to change?
We don't quite go. I mean, I agree that we need to change, and we're trying to see if the model for drinking and driving can be applied to this same context. I think we are, as a nation, becoming addicted, and if you look at some of the patterns of use of technology, especially in the 20-somethings, teens and 20s, they may be sending and receiving texts one or two, one a minute maybe, in some cases with extreme behavior. They're getting up at 3 in the morning, starting to talk on or text, and they carry that kind of behavior of having to compulsively respond back and forth into the car, and that's what the danger is. I'm pretty sure that we'll be continuing this discussion until we as a nation finally say it's not acceptable to basically take your mind off the road. Operating a vehicle has responsibilities, and you can't speed, and you can't run through red lights, and you can't injure or hurt other people. And unfortunately, the trend is right now in the opposite direction, where we're seeing more people starting to text, and more people using Facebook, and you see the auto industry putting in all kinds of electronic gadgets to do access to the internet and have entertainment systems as well. All these things are competing with attention, And, you know, the question is, what kind of a road do you want to drive on? Do you want to drive on a road where everybody else is distracted and watching a movie and talking on the phone and texting? I don't. I don't want my kids to have to interact with that either. So that's, I think, the ultimate question is, you have to say, this is a personal responsibility where we can't drive in that impaired way, just like you can't drive when you're drunk.
And we'll give Rob Reynolds the final word. We have seen some laws being enacted, and there was an executive order, President Obama, banning texting while driving in federal employees. Here in Utah, a texting ban was instituted, especially given impetus by an unfortunate couple of deaths here in Cache Valley. And I believe there's a ban on commercial drivers with texting. What specifically are you looking for next?
Well, we know that there's a couple of communities that are picking up on the NTSB's recommendation, and those communities are going to be pushing for a all-out cell phone ban for drivers. That's hands-free and handheld, as well as texting. And these communities, I believe, already have texting laws in place. They might even have handheld laws in place, and they're going the next logical step. And that's what we're looking for. We're looking for communities to step forward and start testing the waters, so to speak. It does raise the level of awareness. It does raise the level of discussion. And when we're talking about the science behind this, we're not just talking about Dr. Strayer's studies. We're talking about multiple studies that all agree on the same point, that this is a dangerous behavior, and if we were able to get our hands around it, it would save lives.
We'll leave it there. We'll be following this, of course, closely. We've been talking with Rob Reynolds, Executive Director of Focus Driven. The website is focusdriven.org. Thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
And with University of Utah Professor David Strayer, you can find out about his research at University of Utah website. Maybe just do a search for David Strayer. David Strayer, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And coming up, we have a discussion about the New Hampshire primary. Mitt Romney won, Ron Paul second, John Huntsman third. We'll set the scene and get some reaction from New Hampshire Public Radio reporter Dan Gorenstein. That follows a brief break.
I'm Mackenzie Hamilton, and I'd like to invite you to join me and Tom Williams for Evening News at 5:30, new in 2012. A new view with daily reports from Moab, St. George, Cedar City, Vernal, Salt Lake City, Brigham City, and Cache Valley, with the latest weather and air quality conditions from the Utah Climate Center. New for You News, weekday evenings at 5:30 on Utah Public Radio, your favorite public radio station for expanded Utah news.
Support for Access Utah comes from Crum Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan. Now with new hours, open Monday through Saturday 7 until 3 and Saturday 8 until 3, offering a changing menu of French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits and serving lunch sandwiches.
It's Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. You've seen the headlines. A big win for Mitt Romney, solidifying his frontrunner status. 39% of the vote in New Hampshire. In second place, 23%, Ron Paul. And in third place, 17%, former Utah Governor John Huntsman. He says that's a ticket to ride, and he's going on to South Carolina. Part of the New Hampshire Public Radio team that's been covering this primary is Dan Gorenstein. He's been a reporter with New Hampshire Public Radio since 2001. He moved to New Hampshire from the Midwest, got his start in journalism at the Chicago Reporter, an investigative journal, and he covers public policy, politics, poverty, and he says occasionally subjects that don't start with the letter P. Dan Gorenstein, welcome to Access Utah.
Good morning. Thanks so much, Tom, for having me.
Appreciate you coming on. I imagine things were crazy there last night and continue so this morning with the New Hampshire primary.
Yeah, no, it was. The truth is that the New Hampshire primary is very, very special. I'd say it's sacred to people here in New Hampshire. People are really serious about their politics, in part because there's a level of civic engagement in New Hampshire that you don't see in that many other parts of our country. For example, our legislature is 424 members. It's the fourth largest legislature in the English-speaking world. And so what that means is that everybody knows a state rep, everybody knows somebody on the planning board, and so people here kind of get it. And when you got these people who could end up being the leaders of our country coming through and shaking your hand and looking with you and maybe even sometimes sharing a cup of coffee, it's an opportunity that can't be missed. And so you could see last night people were just walking up and down one of the main streets in our largest city, Manchester, and people were thrilled. They were psyched.
People in Hampshire probably hear the grumblings every 4 years that why New Hampshire, why Iowa, why the disproportionate? But people in New Hampshire, I'm hearing from you, and I've heard in other reports, really take this seriously.
Yeah, no, it's been pointed out that New Hampshire, when it comes to primary turnout, you know, voter turnout in these primaries, New Hampshire always ranks in the top three. We really come out, and obviously you can make a case, well, you know, our primaries don't count, so we don't have people come out. But even in general elections, New Hampshire tends to rank in the top 10 in voter turnout. And so, I think it goes back to this sense that we are a small state, and we've got a volunteer legislature, and we've got all these, you know, select boards in the 200-some towns that we have. And so you've got selectmen and women, and you've got people on the town board and the zoning board and all these things. So you have to engage. You have to sort of be responsible for yourself, and that kind of builds off of that sort of libertarian ethic that's here of, look, New Hampshire, you take care of yourself and you take care of your community, and part of that is being involved in politics, even in a nonpartisan way.
That libertarian bent, you would think, would lend itself to support for Ron Paul, and it certainly came through 23% last night. I think 4 years ago he was in single digits. What's changed?
Well, I think, you know, what's changed nationally, I mean, I'm sure to some degree you guys have seen this in Utah, that there's been, you know, the Tea Party has come, and there's been a sense, I think, increasingly, and certainly with the downturn in the economy and the recession, there's even more frustration with our national leaders in Washington, and a sense that this is about money and there's bickering and nobody's really focused on real solutions. And I think something that people in New Hampshire tend to really appreciate is authenticity. You saw that with the kind of support that John McCain got in 2000. I think to some degree you can make the case that Bill Clinton benefited from some kind of sense that he was a sincere person back in the early 90s. And I think that, you know, Ron Paul, regardless of what you think of his policies, you can trust that what Ron Paul says is what Ron Paul's really thinking, and that he's less susceptible to the ways of Washington, despite the fact that he's been a congressman for decades. I think that that really resonated. I think it coincides with the Tea Party movement. And certainly here in New Hampshire, we've got a legislature right now, particularly in our House, that has very similar ideas to some of the concepts that Ron Paul has of really limited government and personal responsibility. So I think those messages resonated with folks. I also think, though, you got an anti-Romney vote. I mean, people in New Hampshire really know Mitt Romney, obviously, who was the governor to our south for years, and he ran in 2008. And I think there is a wing of the Republican Party that is not going to support Mitt Romney.
Of course, people in Utah are interested in the campaign of former Governor John Huntsman, and he set up camp in New Hampshire, did some, I don't know, over 100 events, really worked the retail politics. I wonder if, in the end, Ron Paul siphoned off some of the support that would have gone to John Huntsman.
I don't know about that. I think in New Hampshire, I think there's a sense that Ron Paul... A different kind of voter was attracted to Ron Paul than to John Huntsman. I think the sense among political types in New Hampshire was that John Huntsman, over the weekend, there's a lot of enthusiasm. The Huntsman campaign was talking about momentum building, and there's this real sense that he might have a shot at second, and, you know, all this kind of big talk. for him to do that, though, what people, the consensus was here more or less, is he needed to do really well among moderate voters and very, people who didn't put party first and put country first, but were conservative, fiscally conservative, and maybe a little socially conservative. And he had to do well among wealthy people. And you saw, looking last night at the in the returns, in the towns, Huntsman did okay in the towns that he needed to do okay in, but Romney did better in these communities, these sort of more moderate type, more well-to-do, well-heeled places. And so I think that really Romney was more competition. It proved out that Romney was more competition than Ron Paul with Huntsman.
John Huntsman does say 17% third place is a ticket to ride. He's going on to South Carolina.
he did. He, the scene, the scene for you to create a little picture. Last night we were all, all this press. I couldn't guess how many press people there were. There were probably more press, though, than there were real voters and supporters in this restaurant bar in downtown Manchester. And he came out to, this applause, and people were excited to see him. And he stole the Beatles line, a ticket to ride, and I'm on the way to South Carolina. And his campaign had made it clear, like, we're just looking for momentum, and we just need a sign. And they felt like a top three finish was a sign that they could go on. But you have to wonder. I mean, look, John Huntsman really committed himself to New Hampshire. I mean, the past 4 months, he's become effectively a resident. And he had a third place showing, despite the fact that, as you point out, he so much retail politics. He did twice as many events as any other candidate here, and his message still didn't stick. It's not exactly clear why it didn't stick, but it didn't. And going forward, you just have to wonder, given some of his positions, how well he's going to be received in a place like South Carolina or Florida. And so I think those are real questions for the campaign moving forward.
There seemed to be a lot of undecided people heading into the last day. I don't know. Is that usual in New Hampshire?
Well, I was going to say, welcome to New Hampshire.
Yeah.
The state is about... there are more people who are undeclared, who are registered undeclared, than there are Republican or Democrat. You know, it's about 30% Republican, 30% Democrat, and then, 40% undeclared in New Hampshire. And so I think a lot of people didn't know what they're going to do. We tend to break late. And I think, though, there's also sort of an enthusiasm gap a little bit here for the Republican candidates. And we, that's kind of why Mitt Romney, while he's pretty much been the front runner all along, you had always sort of this flavor of the week or flavor of the month. First it was Herman Cain, and then it was Newt Gingrich, and, this just sort of never-ending cycle of the new flavor of the week. And I think that's all in some way really commentary on the popularity of Romney, and the sense that, the question that keeps nagging Mitt Romney, of course, is this guy authentic? Is this guy someone, as a conservative voter, I can trust, who's going to do what he says he's going to do? Or is he one of those people who licks his finger and holds it up to the wind?
And what
so
do...
I think that kind of explains a little bit why there's so many people who just weren't convinced.
It seems like when they got into the voting booth, quite a few people decided, yes, we can trust Mitt Romney.
Well, again, Mitt Romney, he's been the Massachusetts governor. A lot of people who live in it's not like out west where you guys have these huge states and it takes, a couple of hours to get to the next state. I mean, I live in Concord, the capital of New Hampshire. We're an hour from Boston. Although culturally it feels a lot farther than that, geographically it's not. And so there are a lot of people, particularly in the most populated part of the state, the so-called southern tier, which shares the border with Massachusetts. And you've got all these people who used to live in Massachusetts, who know Mitt Romney, who probably voted for Mitt Romney when he was governor. and they like him, and they know him. And Mitt Romney has a house. He's got a summer house on a lake up here in New Hampshire. So he's been running for president for a long time here in New Hampshire. So I think people know him, and history bears out that New Hampshire tends to back Massachusetts candidates, whether they're on the Democratic side or the Republican side. And certainly we supported John Kerry back in 2004. So I think those are some of the reasons that you saw the kind of support that you got last night. But let's not forget, I mean, this time around, Mitt Romney's sort of he's the front runner. He's the establishment candidate here. And Republicans often like that establishment candidate.
I wanted to ask you about the Mormon question. Two Mormon candidates, and they finished 1 and 3. There's been a fair amount of talk coming and going about religion. Was that a part of the discussion? Was that on the radar in New Hampshire?
I don't think so. John Huntsman, and I certainly didn't attend all of that many events with him, but John Huntsman doesn't wear his religion on his sleeve the way a Rick Santorum does. I'll tell you, that kind of show of faith doesn't play well in New Hampshire. It's a much more secular kind of place, even if people are religious. That's between you and your own God. That's not between you and the person you're trying to get their vote from. So I think that you know, there just wasn't a lot of talk about, oh, he's a Mormon. I mean, I think when people talked about the Mormon issue, the question was, and I'm sure it's true for people in Utah, I'm sure you guys wonder this as well, can a Mormon be elected president of the United States? Are there enough people nationwide who are willing to support a Mormon for president? I think that's the issue. And so it always kind of come down more to electability. But, it's my sense that with Huntsman, at least, people sort of forgot about his religion and just sort of more focused on who he was, that he was, you know, the easy thing to gravitate to was the fact that he was here and he was dedicated, he was devoted to New Hampshire. And I think he got, you know, look, on Friday he was polling at 7% and he ended up with 17%. And I think, you know, I talked to at least one voter last night at his campaign party, who the election night result party, and she said, I got to meet John Huntsman 4 times. And one of those times we sat and we talked for 10 minutes. And New Hampshire people are susceptible. Somebody who's going to press the flesh like that is going to give you 10 minutes and sit down and look you in the eye. That goes a long way.
And I was just thinking, this maybe is good or maybe is bad. Maybe you couldn't pick two more different places than New Hampshire and South Carolina. It's a real sort of a head turner when you know you've been in New Hampshire, now you go to South Carolina, a whole different climate.
Yeah, I mean, let me just say, I spent a night at the zoo, but that's a different story for a different show. So I don't know that much about South Carolina, but I do know that, you know, all a political observer needs to know is that, you know, going into the New Hampshire primary, people are like, well, how's Huntsman going to play? You know, this is a Huntsman kind of spot, or this is a Ron Paul kind of spot. And South Carolina, people are saying, this is a Santorum kind of spot. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, Santorum and Paul and Huntsman, I mean, those are different characters from each other, and so it's certainly a much more socially conservative kind of climate. Religion, I think, does play a larger role for people. I think some more social issues perhaps play a larger role than they do in New Hampshire. People up here were pretty focused on economic issues, tax policy, what's going to happen with businesses, you know, what are we going to do about job creation? Less about abortion or gay marriage. I mean, you know, New Hampshire is one of the handful of states in the country that has gay marriage on the books. And, you know, that just wasn't, we didn't talk about it. I could imagine that people in South Carolina over these next few days are going to be talking about issues more like that.
So if Mitt Romney is the Republican nominee, do you expect New Hampshire to go for him in the general election?
putting it to me, huh?
your prediction.
Well, don't go to Las Vegas with this prediction, but I think that they're going to be on the local level in New Hampshire this fall. There are going to be some pretty strong Republican candidates. The Democrats have a couple of people who are one person's announced, and you know the sense among the chattering class in New Hampshire is that the Republicans have stronger candidates, and that on a local level, that's going to help drive some of this, and also some of the candidates for Congress. You know, the sort of cliche that the Democrat bench is a little thin, and how that ends up affecting turnout. You know, maybe more Republicans come out. I mean, certainly Barack Obama has his supporters, and they have an organization. Somebody actually, as a matter of fact, on primary day for the Obama campaign knocked on my door asking me, reminding me that it's primary day and to go to the polls. And this is, you know, there's no primary for Barack Obama, basically. I mean, he wasn't really running. He had no competition. But yet and still, they had field operatives out here. I think that people understand New Hampshire is in play. It's a swing state. It's only 4 electoral college votes, but it is in play. And I think it's going to be close. New Hampshire is definitely one of the purple places in our country. And so you asked me to guess, and if I had to guess, I would say Romney. But I'm not. It's only because you're pushing me.
Very good. And of course, we'll be looking at this with interest. We've been talking with Dan Gorenstein, who's a reporter with the New Hampshire Public Radio, looking at the New Hampshire primary, which was, of course, yesterday. Thanks so much.
Tom, thank you so much. Have a good day.
Okay, you too. Coming up following a brief break, we're going to look at a new program which is designed to help developers to comply with the Endangered Species Act, especially with regard to the prairie dog. I'll be talking with Don Falvey with the Panorama Land Conservation Council. That's following a break.
Hi, this is Blair Larson, host of Fresh Folk. On the show this week, I feature the 14th stellar album from Alison Krauss and Union Station, as well as the latest album from the one and only Dr. Ralph Stanley. I'll also play songs from new releases by Donnie Ulisse, James Reams, and John Reichman, to name just a few. Tune in and listen this Saturday at 8 p.m. for Fresh Folk on Utah Public Radio.
Support for Utah Public Radio comes from area-info.net, providing a social media outlet for personalized national, financial, and lifestyle news, plus travel and entertainment. Information is at area-info.net.
We conclude the program today looking at a quote from the Associated Press. Program officials in southern Utah are unveiling a market-based program they say will protect the state's prairie dogs and make life easier for developers trying to work with the Endangered Species Act. And I'm speaking with Don Falvey, chairman of the Panorama Land Conservation Council. Mr. Falvey, thanks. Welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, Tom. It's good to be here.
Apparently, according to the news report, this is it's called the Utah Prairie Dog Habitat Credit Exchange and Safe Harbor Program. What will this do?
Well, we're doing a couple of things with this. Maybe I could back up just a little bit, Tom.
Certainly.
The group that I'm with is called the Resource Conservation and Development Council. There are 7 of those councils within the state of Utah, and we are federally recognized 501c3 organizations. And we have the mission working within Utah, within particularly Panorama Land, our C&D Council. We serve the people in the south-central part of the state in conserving and improving their social, economic, and environmental conditions. And so we've been working on a variety of projects, trying to get recycling going for one, and have been working on this prairie dog program also. We have been working for the past few years on developing safe harbor agreements with local landowners under the approval from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And these are more of a temporary kind of agreements that we have with landowners that they can improve their habitat and in exchange for preserving their habitat for prairie dogs, they are allowed some incidental take as part of their work. The Habitat Credit Exchange Program is a pilot program that we've just we've made some tremendous efforts in getting implemented now. The basics of the program, as you mentioned earlier, it is a market-based brokerage system. And through that system, we buy conservation easements from landowners that are willing to support the prairie dogs on their property, ones that already have them on their property. And then with the conservation easement, we buy credits. And then having those credits in hand, then we can market those to developers that need to clear their land for development. So that's the basics of the program. It tends to work better for the developers that are larger in scale. And over the years, since the prairie dog has been listed initially as an endangered species and now as a threatened species, that there's been various efforts to address development issues caused by that listing. Like a Utah prairie dog recovery team has been established that advises the force of the Fish and Wildlife Service, and a recovery plan has been prepared, and an umbrella organization has been formed too. It's called UPRIP. These good acronyms.
Yeah.
Utah Prairie Dog Recovery Implementation Program, which is why it's called UPRIP. Mm. But there are a variety of organizations working to try to recover the species. And this habitat conservation or habitat credits program is just the latest in this.
Just very briefly, just 30 seconds left. This has a program like this or similar programs been successful other places to reduce conflict between developers and conservationists?
They have, although this one I think is fairly unique because we are concentrating on the Utah prairie dog, and it is a pilot program. We were able to receive some funding from the grant from the NRCS, the Natural Resource Conservation Service, to get this program going. So it is a pilot program, but we have great expectations it's going to work and really help the people in Iron County.
Very good. This is the Utah Prairie Dog Habitat Credit Exchange and Safe Harbor Program, and we've been talking about that program with Don Falvey from the Panorama Land Conservation Council. Thanks so much.
Well, you're welcome, Tom.
And thanks for listening to Access Utah. Hope you'll be with us tomorrow, 9 to 10, for the program. Access Utah on Utah Public Radio. Thanks for listening.
Access Utah is a production of Utah Public Radio. You can listen to this episode or previous episodes of Access Utah anytime at upr.org, where you can find a link to subscribe to our podcast. This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1 88.7 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.